in a little wagon, and sometimes she sat down on the floor, disoriented. "Come, Ima," I said, over and over. "Listen to what Aunt Lena is saying." But she continued to play with the wagon. My daughter did not have the qualities of Leela's daughter. A few days earlier, the anxiety that she was in some way retarded had dissipated. I had taken her to a very good pediatrician. The child showed no retardation of any sort. I was reassured. And yet, comparing Ima to Tina continued to make me uneasy. How lively Tina was. To see her, to hear her talk, put you in a good mood. And to see mother and daughter together was touching. As long as Leela talked about the computer, we were starting then to use that word, I observed them both with admiration. At that moment, I felt happy, satisfied with myself, and so I also felt, very clearly, that I loved my friend for how she was, for her virtues and her flaws, for everything, even for that being she had brought into the world. The child was full of curiosity. She learned everything in an instant. She had a large vocabulary and a surprising manual dexterity. I said to myself, "She has little of Enzo. She's like Leela. Look how she widens her eyes, narrows them. Look at the ears that have no lobe." I still didn't dare to admit that Tina attracted me more than my daughter. But when that demonstration of skill ended, I was very excited about the computer and full of praise for the little girl, even though I knew that Ima might suffer from it. "How clever you are. How pretty. How well you speak. How many things you learn." I complimented Leela, mainly to diminish the unease I had caused her by announcing the publication of my book. And finally, I drew an optimistic portrait of the future that awaited my three daughters and hers. "They'll study," I said. "They'll travel all over the world. Goodness knows what they'll be." But Leela, after smothering Tina with kisses, "Yes, she's so clever," replied bitterly. "Gennaro was clever, too. He spoke well. He read. He was very good in school. And look at him now." 83. One night, when Leela was speaking disparagingly of Gennaro, Dede gathered her courage and defended him. She became red-faced. She said, "He's extremely intelligent." Leela looked at her with interest, smiled, replied, "You're very nice. I'm his mama, and what you say gives me great pleasure." From then on, Dede felt authorized to defend Gennaro on every occasion, even when Leela was very angry at him. Gennaro was now a large boy of 18, with a handsome face, like his father's as a youth, but he was stockier and had a surly nature. He didn't even notice Dede, who was 12. He had other things on his mind. But she never stopped thinking of him as the most astonishing human creature who had ever appeared on the face of the earth. And whenever she could, she sang his praises. Sometimes Leela was in a bad mood and didn't respond. But on other occasions, she laughed. She exclaimed, "Certainly not. He's a delinquent. You three sisters, on the other hand, you're clever. You'll be better than your mother." And Dede, although pleased with the compliment, when she could consider herself better than me, she was happy, immediately began to belittle herself in order to elevate Gennaro. She adored him. She would often sit at the window to watch for his return from the shop, shouting at him as soon as he appeared, "Hi, Reno!" If he answered hi, usually he didn't, she hurried to the landing to wait for him to come up the stairs, and then tried to start a serious conversation like, "You're tired. What did you do to your hand? Aren't you hot in those overalls?" Things of that sort. Even a few words from him excited her. If she happened to get more attention than usual, In order to prolong it, she grabbed Ima and said, "I'm taking her down to Aunt Lena so she can play with Tina." I didn't have time to give her permission before she was out of the house. Never had so little space separated Leela and me, not even when we were children. My floor was her ceiling. Two flights of stairs down brought me to her house. Two up brought her to mine. In the morning, in the evening, I heard their voices, the indistinct sounds of conversations. Tina's trills that Leela responded to, as if she too were trilling. The thick tonality of Enzo, who, silent as he was, spoke a lot to his daughter and often sang to her. I supposed that the signs of my presence also reached Leela. When she was at work, when my older daughters were at school, when only Ima and Tina, who often stayed with me, sometimes even to sleep, were at home, I noticed the emptiness below. I listened for the footsteps of Leela and Enzo returning. Things soon took a turn for the better. Dede and Elsa frequently looked after Ima. They carried her down to the courtyard with them or to Leela's. If I had to go out, Leela took care of all three. It was years since I had had so much time available. I read. I revised my book. I was at ease without Nino, and free of the anxiety of losing him. Also, my relationship with Pietro improved. He came to Naples more often to see the girls. He got used to the small, dreary apartment and to their Neapolitan accents, Elsa's especially, and he often stayed overnight. At those times, he was polite to Enzo and talked a lot to Leela. Even though in the past Pietro had had definitely negative opinions of her, it seemed clear that he was happy to spend time in her company. As for Leela, as soon as he left, she began to talk about him with an enthusiasm she rarely showed for anyone. "How many books must he have studied?" she said seriously. 50,000? 100,000? I think she saw in my ex-husband the incarnation of her childhood fantasies about people who read and write for knowledge, not as a profession. "You're very smart," she said to me one evening, "but he has a way of speaking that I truly like. He puts the writing into his voice, but he doesn't speak like a printed book." "I do?" I asked, as a joke.
"A little."
"Even now?"
"Yes."
If I hadn't learned to speak like that, I would never have had any respect outside of here.
"He's like you, but more natural. When Gennaro was little, I thought, even though I didn't know Pietro yet, I thought I'd want him to become just like that."
She often talked about her son. She said she should have given him more, but she hadn't had time or consistency or ability. She accused herself of having taught him the little she could, and of having then lost confidence and stopped. One night, she went from her first child to the second without interruption. She was afraid that Tina, too, as she grew up, would be a waste. I praised Tina, sincerely, and she said in a serious tone, "Now that you're here, you have to help her become like your daughters. It's important to Enzo, too. He told me to ask you."
"All right.
You help me, I'll help you. School isn't enough. You remember Maestra Oliviero. With me, it wasn't enough."
"They were different times."
"I don't know. I gave Gennaro what was possible, but it went badly."
"It's the fault of the neighborhood."
She looked at me gravely. She said, "I don't have much faith in it, but since you've decided to stay here with us, let's change the neighborhood."
84. In a few months, we became very close. We got in the habit of going out together to do the shopping, and on Sundays, rather than strolling amid the stalls on the Stradone, We insisted on going to the center of town with Enzo, so that our daughters could have the sun and the sea air. We walked along Via Caracciolo, or in the Villa Comunale. He carried Tina on his shoulders. He pampered her, maybe too much. But he never forgot my daughters. He bought balloons, sweets. He played with them. Lila and I stayed behind them on purpose. We talked about everything, but not the way we had as adolescents. Those times would never return. She asked questions about things she had heard on television, and I answered volubly. I talked about the postmodern, the problems of publishing, the latest news of feminism, whatever came into my mind. And Lila listened attentively, her expression just slightly ironic, interrupting only to ask for further explanations, never to say what she thought. I liked talking to her. I liked her look of admiration. I liked it when she said, "How many things you know, how many things you think," even when I felt she was teasing. If I pressed for her opinion, she retreated, saying, "No, don't make me say something stupid. You talk." Often she asked me about famous people, to find out if I knew them, and when I said no, she was disappointed. She was also disappointed, I should say, when I reduced to ordinary dimensions well-known people I'd had dealings with. "So," she concluded one morning, "those people aren't what they seem." "Not at all. Often they're good at their work, but otherwise they're greedy. They like hurting you. They're allied with the strong, and they persecute the weak. They form gangs to fight other gangs. They treat women like dogs on a leash. They'll utter obscenities and put their hands on you, exactly the way they do on the buses here."
"You're exaggerating?"
"No. To produce ideas, you don't have to be a saint. And anyway, there are very few true intellectuals. The mass of the educated spend their lives commenting lazily on the ideas of others. They engage their best energies in sadistic practices against every possible rival."
"Then why are you with them?"
I answered, "I'm not with them. I'm here." I wanted her to feel that I was part of an upper-class world, and yet different. She herself pushed me in that direction. She was amused if I was sarcastic about my colleagues. Sometimes I had the impression that she insisted so that I would confirm that I really was one of those who told people how things stood and what they should think. The decision to live in the neighborhood made sense to her only if I continued to count myself among those who wrote books, contributed to magazines and newspapers, appeared sometimes on television. She wanted me as her friend, her neighbor, provided I had that aura. And I supported her. Her approval gave me confidence. I was beside her in the Villa Comunale with our daughters. And yet, I was definitively different. I had a wide-ranging life. It flattered me to feel that, compared to her, I was a woman of great experience, and I felt that she, too, was pleased with what I was. I told her about France, Germany, and Austria, about the United States, the debates I had taken part in here and there, the men there had been recently, after Nino. She was attentive to every word with a half-smile, never saying what she thought. Not even the story of my occasional relationships set off in her a need to confide. "Are you happy with Enzo?" I asked one morning.
"Enough."
"And you've never been interested in someone else?"
"No."
"Do you really love him?"
"Enough."
There was no way of getting anything else out of her. It was I who talked about sex, and often in an explicit way. My ramblings, her silences. Yet, whatever the subject, During those walks, something was released from her very body that enthralled me, stimulating my brain as it always had, helping me reflect. Maybe that was why I sought her out. She continued to emit an energy that gave comfort, that reinforced a purpose, that spontaneously suggested solutions. It was a force that struck not only me. Sometimes she invited me to dinner with the children. More often, I invited her with Enzo and naturally Tina. Gennaro, no, there was nothing to be done. He often stayed out and came home late at night. Enzo, I soon realized, was worried about him, whereas Leela said, "He's grown up. Let him do as he likes." But I felt she spoke that way to reduce her partner's anxiety, and the tone was identical to that of our conversations. Enzo nodded. Something passed from her to him like an invigorating tonic. It was no different on the streets of the neighborhood. Going shopping with her never ceased to amaze me. She had become an authority. She was constantly stopped. People drew her aside with a respectful familiarity. They whispered something to her, and she listened, without reacting. Did they treat her like that because of the success she had had with her new business? Because she gave off the sense of someone who could do anything? Or because, now that she was nearly 40, the energy she had always had imbued her with the aura of a magician who cast spells and instilled fear? I don't know. Of course, it struck me that people paid more attention to her than to me. I was a well-known writer, and the publishing house was making sure that, in view of my new book, I was often mentioned in the newspapers. The Repubblica had come out with a fairly large photograph of me to illustrate a short article on forthcoming books, which at a certain point said, "Highly anticipated is the new novel by Elena Greco, a story set in an unknown Naples with blood-red colors, etc." And yet, next to her, in the place where we were born, I was only a decoration. That is, I bore witness to Leela's merits. Those who had known us from birth attributed to her, to the force of her attraction, the fact that the neighborhood could have on its streets an esteemed person like me. 85. I think there were many who wondered why I, who in the newspapers seemed rich and famous, had come to live in a wretched apartment, situated in an increasingly run-down area. Maybe the first not to understand were my daughters. Dede came home from school one day, disgusted. "An old man peed in our doorway." Another day, Elsa arrived terrified. "Today, someone was knifed in the gardens." At such times, I was afraid. The part of me that had long ago left the neighborhood was indignant, was worried about the children, and said, "Enough." At home, Dede and Elsa spoke a good Italian. But occasionally, I heard them from the window or coming up the stairs, and I realized that Elsa especially used a very aggressive, sometimes obscene dialect. I reprimanded her. She pretended to be sorry. But I knew that it took a lot of self-discipline to resist the lure of bad behavior and so many other temptations. Was it possible that while I was devoting myself to making literature, they were getting lost? I calmed myself by repeating the temporal limit of this stay. After the publication of my book, I would definitively leave Naples. I said it to myself and said it again. I needed only to reach a final draft of the novel. The book was undoubtedly benefiting from everything that came from the neighborhood, but the work proceeded so well mainly because I was attentive to Leela, who had remained completely within that environment. Her voice, her gaze, her gestures, her meanness and her generosity, her dialect were all intimately connected to our place of birth. Even Basic Sight, in spite of the exotic name, people called her office Basisit, didn't seem some sort of meteorite that had fallen from outer space, but rather the unexpected product of poverty, violence, and blight. Thus, drawing on her to give truth to my story seemed indispensable. Afterward, I would leave for good. I intended to move to Milan. I had only to sit in her office for a while to understand the background against which she moved. I looked at her brother, who was now openly consumed by drugs. I looked at Ada, who was crueler every day, the sworn enemy of Marisa, who had taken Stefano away from her. I looked at Alfonso, in whose face, in whose habits, the feminine and the masculine continually broke boundaries with effects that one day repelled me, the next moved me, and always alarmed me, who often had a black eye or a split lip because of the beatings he got, who knows where, who knows when. I looked at Carmen, who, in the blue jacket of a gas pump attendant, drew Leela aside and interrogated her like an oracle. I looked at Antonio, who hovered around her with unfinished sentences, or stood in a serene silence when he brought to the office, as if on a courtesy visit, his beautiful German wife, the children. Meanwhile, I picked up endless rumors. Stefano Caracci is about to close the grocery. He doesn't have a lira. He needs money. It was Pasquale Peluso who kidnapped so-and-so, and if it wasn't him, he certainly had something to do with it. That other so-and-so set fire to the shirt factory in Afragola by himself to fuck the insurance company. Watch out for Dede. They're giving children drugged candy. There's a faggot hanging around the elementary school who lures children away. The Saladas are opening a nightclub in the new neighborhood. Women and drugs. The music will be so loud that no one will sleep again. Big trucks pass by on the Stradone at night, transporting stuff that can destroy us faster than the atomic bomb. Gennaro has started hanging out with a bad crowd, and if he continues like that, I won't even let him go to work. The person they found murdered in the tunnel looked like a woman, but was a man. There was so much blood in the body that it flowed all the way down to the gas pump. I observed. I listened. From the vantage point of what Leela and I, as children, had imagined becoming, and what I had actually become, the author of a big book that I was polishing, or at times rewriting, and that would soon be published. In the first draft, I said to myself, I put too much dialect, and I erased it, rewrote. Then it seemed that I had put in too little, and I added some. I was in the neighborhood, and yet safe in that role, within that setting. The ambitious work justified my presence there, and, as long as I was occupied with it, gave meaning to the poor light in the rooms, the rough voices of the street, the risks that the children ran, the traffic on the Stradone that raised dust when the weather was good, and water and mud when it rained. Leela and Enzo's swarm of clients, small provincial entrepreneurs, big luxury cars, clothes of a vulgar wealth, heavy bodies that moved sometimes aggressively, sometimes with servile manners. Once, when I was waiting for Leela at Basic Sight with Ima and Tina, everything seemed to become clearer. Leela was doing new work, but totally immersed in our old world. I heard her shouting at a client in an extremely crude way about a question of money. I was shaken. Where had the woman who graciously emanated authority suddenly gone? Enzo hurried in, and the man, a small man around 60 with an enormous belly, went away cursing. Afterward, I said to Leela, "Who are you, really? In what sense? If you don't want to talk about it, forget it." "No, let's talk. But explain what you mean." I mean, in an environment like this, with the people you have to deal with, how do you behave?
I'm careful, like everyone.
That's all?
Well, I'm careful, and I move things around in order to make them go the way I say. Haven't we always behaved that way?
Yes, but now we have responsibilities toward ourselves and our children. Didn't you say we have to change the neighborhood?
And to change it, what do you think needs to be done?
Resort to the law. I was startled myself by what I was saying. I made a speech in which I was, to my surprise, even more legalistic than my ex-husband, and, in many ways, more than Nino.
Leela said teasingly, "The law is fine when you're dealing with people who pay attention if you merely say the word law. But you know how it is here."
"And so?"
"So if people have no fear of the law, you have to instill the fear yourself. We did a lot of work for that shit you saw before. In fact, a huge amount. But he won't pay. He says he has no money. I threatened him. I told him, I'll sue you. And he answered, sue me. Who gives a damn?"
"But you'll sue him."
She laughed. "I'll never see my money that way. Some time ago, an accountant stole millions from us. We fired him and filed charges, but the law didn't lift a finger."
"So?"
"I was fed up with waiting, and I asked Antonio. The money was returned immediately. And this money, too, will return, without a trial, without lawyers, and without judges." 86. So, Antonio did that sort of work for Leela. Not for money, but out of friendship, or personal respect. Or, I don't know, maybe she asked Michele if she could borrow him, since Antonio worked for Michele, and Michele, who agreed to everything Leela asked, let her. But did Michele really satisfy her every request? If it had certainly been true before I moved to the neighborhood, now it wasn't clear if things really were like that. First, I noticed some odd signs. Leela no longer uttered Michele's name with condescension, but rather with irritation or obvious concern. Mainly, though, he hardly ever appeared at basic sight. It was at the wedding celebration of Marcello and Elisa, which was ostentatious and lavish, that I became aware something had changed. During the entire reception, Marcello stayed close to his brother. He often whispered to him. They laughed together. He put an arm around his shoulders. As for Michele, he seemed revived. He had returned to making long, pompous speeches as he used to, while the children and Giliola, now extraordinarily fat, sat obediently beside him, as if they had decided to forget the way he had treated them. It struck me how the vulgarity, which was still very provincial at the time of Leela's wedding, had been as if modernized. It had become a metropolitan vulgarity, and Leela herself was appropriate to it, in her habits, in her language, in her clothes. Nothing clashed, in other words, except for me and my daughters, who, with our sobriety, were completely out of place in that triumph of excessive colors, excessive laughter, excessive luxuries. Perhaps that was why Michele's burst of rage was especially alarming. He was making a speech in honor of the newlyweds, but meanwhile, little Tina was claiming something that Ima had taken away from her and was screaming in the middle of the room. He was talking. Tina was crying. Suddenly, Michele broke off and, with the eyes of a madman, shouted, "Fuck, Leela, will you shut that piece of shit kid up?" Like that. Exactly in those words.
Leela stared at him for a long second. She didn't speak. She didn't move. Very slowly, she placed one hand on the hand of Enzo, who was sitting next to her. I quickly got up from my table and took the two little girls outside. The episode roused the bride, that is to say, my sister Elisa. At the end of the speech, when the sound of applause reached me, she came out in her extravagant white dress. She said cheerfully, "My brother-in-law has returned to himself." Then she added, "But he shouldn't treat babies like that." She picked up Ima and Tina and, laughing and joking, returned to the hall with the two children. I followed her, confused. For a while, I thought that she, too, had returned to herself. Elisa, in fact, did change greatly after her marriage, as if what had ruined her had been the absence, until that moment, of the marriage bond. She became a calm mother, a tranquil yet firm wife. Her hostility toward me ended. Now, when I went to her house with my daughters, and often Tina, she welcomed me politely and was affectionate with the children. Even Marcello, when I ran into him, was courteous. He called me the sister-in-law who writes novels. "How is the sister-in-law who writes novels?" said a cordial word or two, and disappeared. The house was always tidy, and Elisa and Silvio welcomed us dressed as if for a party. But my sister as a little girl, I soon realized, had vanished forever. The marriage had inaugurated a completely fake Signora Solara. Never an intimate word, only a good-humored tone and a smile, all copied from her husband. I made an effort to be loving with her, and especially with my nephew. But I didn't find Silvio appealing. He was too much like Marcello, and Elisa must have realized it. One afternoon, she turned bitter again for a few minutes. She said, "You love Lena's child more than mine." I swore it wasn't true. I hugged the child, kissed him. But she shook her head, whispered, "Besides, you went to live near Lena, and not near me or Papa." She continued, in other words, to be angry with me, and now also with our brothers. I think she accused them of behaving like ingrates. They lived and worked in Baiano, and they weren't even in touch with Marcello, who had been so generous with them. "Family ties," said Elisa. "You think they're strong, but no." She talked as if she were stating a universal principle. Then she added, "To keep from breaking those ties, you need, as my husband has shown, goodwill." Michele had turned into an idiot, but Marcello restored his mind to him. "Did you notice what a great speech he made at my wedding?" 87. Michele's return to his senses was marked not only by a return to his flowery speech, but also by the absence among the guests of a person who, during that period of crisis, had been very close to him, Alfonso. Not to be invited was, for my former schoolmate, a source of great suffering. For days he did nothing but complain, asking aloud how he had wronged the Solaras. "I worked for them for so many years," he said, "and they didn't invite me." Then something happened that caused a sensation. One evening he came to dinner at my house with Lila and Enzo, very depressed. But Alfonso, who had never dressed as a woman in my presence, except the day he tried on the maternity dress in the shop on Via Chiaia, arrived in women's clothes, leaving Dede and Elsa speechless. He was troublesome all evening. He drank a lot. He asked Lila obsessively, "Am I getting fat? Am I getting ugly? Do I not look like you anymore?" And Enzo, "Who's prettier, her or me?" At a certain point he complained that he had a blocked intestine, that he had a terrible pain in what, addressing the girls, he called his ass. And he began to insist that I look and see what was wrong. "Look at my ass," he said, laughing in an obscene way. And Dede stared at him in bewilderment. Elsa tried to stifle a laugh. Enzo and Leela had to take him away in a hurry. But Alfonso didn't calm down. The next day, without makeup, in male clothes, eyes red with crying, he left Basic Sight, saying that he was going to have a coffee at the Bar Salada. At the entrance, he met Michele, and they said something to each other. Michele, after a few minutes, began to punch and kick him. Then he grabbed the pole that was used to lower the shutter and beat him methodically for a long time. Alfonso returned to the office badly battered, but he couldn't stop repeating, "It's my fault. I don't know how to control myself." Control? In what way, we couldn't understand. Certainly, he got even worse, and Leela seemed worried. For days, she tried in vain to soothe Enzo, who couldn't bear the violence of the strong against the weak, and wanted to go to Michele to see if he could beat him, Enzo, the way he had beaten Alfonso. From my apartment, I heard Leela saying, "Stop it. You're frightening Tina." 88. January arrived, and my book was now enriched by echoes of many small details of the neighborhood. A great anguish came over me. When I was at the last stage of proofs, I timidly asked Leela if she had the patience to reread it. "It's very changed." But she answered decisively, "No." "I didn't read the last one you published," she said. "Those are things in which I have no expertise." I felt alone, at the mercy of my own pages, and I was even tempted to call Nino to ask if he would do me a favor and read it. Then I realized that, although he knew my address and phone number, he had never appeared. In all those months, he had ignored both me and his daughter. So I gave up. The text moved beyond the final provisional stage and disappeared. Separating from it frightened me. I would see it again only in its definitive guise, and every word would be irremediable. The publicity office telephoned. Gina said, "At Panorama, they've read the proofs and are very interested. They'll send a photographer." Suddenly, I missed the elegant apartment on Via Tasso. I thought, I don't want to be photographed again at the entrance of the tunnel, or in this dreary apartment, or even in the gardens amid the syringes of the addicts. I'm not the girl of 15 years ago. This is my third book. I want to be treated properly. But Gina insisted. The book had to be promoted. I told her, "Give the photographer my phone number." I wanted at least to be notified ahead of time. Attend to my appearance. Put off the meeting if I didn't feel in good shape. In those days, I tried to keep the house in order, but no one called. I concluded that there were already enough photographs of me around, and that Panorama had decided not to do the article. But one morning, when Dede and Elsa were at school and I was sitting on the floor in jeans and a worn-out sweater, my hair uncombed, playing with Ima and Tina, the doorbell rang. The two little girls were building a castle with blocks that were scattered around, and I was helping them. In the past few months, it had seemed to me that the distance between my daughter and Leela's had been bridged. They collaborated on the construction with precise gestures, and if Tina appeared more imaginative and often asked me surprising questions in a pure Italian, always clearly pronounced, Ima was more decisive, maybe more disciplined, and her only disadvantage was a constricted language that we often needed her friend to decipher. Since I delayed going to the door as I finished answering some question or other of Tina's, there was a commanding ring. I opened the door and found myself facing a beautiful woman of around 30, with blonde curls, a long blue raincoat. She was the photographer. She turned out to be a very gregarious Milanese, expensively dressed. I lost your number, she said, but just as well. The less you expect to be photographed, the better the photos. She looked around. What a job to get here. What a wretched place. But it's exactly what's needed. Are these your babies? Tina smiled at her. Ema didn't. But it was obvious that they both considered her a kind of fairy. I introduced them. Ema is my daughter, and Tina, the daughter of a friend. But even as I was speaking, the photographer began to wander around, snapping photos constantly with different cameras and all her equipment. I have to pull myself together, I tried to say. Not at all. You're fine like that. She pushed me into every part of the house, the kitchen, the children's room, my bedroom, even in front of the bathroom mirror. Do you have your book? No, it's not out yet. A copy of the last one you wrote? Yes. Take it and sit here. Pretend to be reading. I obeyed in a daze. Tina grabbed a book, too, and assumed the same pose, saying to Ema, take a picture of me. This excited the photographer. She said, sit on the floor with the children. She took a lot of pictures. Tina and Ema were happy. She exclaimed, now let's do one alone with your daughter. I tried to pull Ema to me, but she said, no, the other one. She has a fantastic face. She pushed Tina toward me. She took an infinite number of pictures. Ema became upset. Me too, she said. I opened my arms. I called to her. Yes, come to Mama. The morning flew by. The woman in the blue raincoat dragged us out of the house, but was somewhat tense. She asked a couple of times, they won't steal my equipment? Then she got carried away. She wanted to photograph every squalid corner of the neighborhood. She placed me on a broken-down bench against a flaking wall next to the old urinal. I said to Ema and Tina, stay here. Don't move, because the cars are going by. I'm warning you. They held each other by the hand, one fair and one dark, the same height, and waited. Lila returned from work at dinner time and came up to get her daughter. Tina didn't wait for her to come in before she told her all about it.
A beautiful lady came.
More beautiful than me?
Yes.
Even more beautiful than Aunt Linucha?
No.
So Aunt Linucha is the prettiest of all?
No, me.
You? What nonsense you talk.
It's true, Mama.
And what did this lady do?
Took photos.
Of whom?
Of me.
Only you?
Yes.
Liar. Ema, come here. Tell me what you did. 89. I waited for Panorama to come out. I was pleased now. The publicity office was doing a good job. I felt proud of being the subject of an entire photographic feature. But a week passed, and the feature didn't appear. 2 weeks passed. Nothing. It was the end of March. The book was in the bookstores, and still nothing. I was absorbed in other things, an interview on the radio, one in the Il Mattino. At a certain point, I had to go to Milan for the launch of the book. I did it in the same bookstore as 15 years earlier, introduced by the same professor. Adele didn't come, nor did Maria Rosa. But the audience was bigger than in the past. The professor talked about the book without much warmth, but positively. And some members of the audience, it was mostly women, spoke up enthusiastically about the complex humanity of the protagonist. A rite that I knew well by now. I left the next morning and returned to Naples, exhausted. I remember that I was heading home, dragging my suitcase, when a car pulled up along the Stradone. At the wheel was Michele. Next to him sat Marcello. I remembered when the two Salatas had tried to pull me into their car, They had done it with Ada, too. And Leela had defended me. I had on my wrist, as I had then, my mother's bracelet. And, though objects are impassive by nature, I drew back with a start to protect it. But Marcello stared straight ahead without greeting me. He didn't even say in his usual good-humored tone, "Here's the sister-in-law who writes novels."
Michele spoke. He was furious.
"Lenu, what the fuck did you write in that book? Despicable things about the place you were born? Despicable things about my family? Despicable things about the people who watched you grow up and who admire you and love you? Despicable things about this beautiful city of ours?"
He turned around and took from the back seat a copy of Panorama, fresh from the printer, and held it out through the window.
"You like talking shit?"
I looked. The weekly was open to the page about me. There was a big color photo that showed Tina and me sitting on the floor at my apartment. The caption struck me immediately. Elena Greco with her daughter Tina. At first, I thought that the problem was the caption, and I didn't understand why Michele was so angry. I said, bewildered, "They made a mistake." But he shouted out a sentence, even more incomprehensible.
"They aren't the ones who made a mistake. It was you two."
At that point, Marcello interrupted. He said with irritation, "Forget it, Mike. Lena manipulates her, and she doesn't even realize it." He took off, tires screeching, and left me on the sidewalk with the magazine in my hand. 90. I stood stock still, my suitcase beside me. I read the article, 4 pages, with pictures of the ugliest places in the neighborhood. The only one with me was the one with Tina, a beautiful picture in which the bleak background of the apartment gave our 2 figures a particular refinement. The writer wasn't reviewing my book and didn't speak of it as a novel, but used it to give an account of what he called the dominion of the Salada brothers, a borderland territory, perhaps tied to the new organized Camorra, perhaps not. Of Marcello, it said little, alluding mainly to Michele, to whom it attributed initiative, unscrupulousness, a tendency to jump from one political cart to the next, according to the logic of business. What business? Panorama made a list, mixing the legal and the illegal. The bar pastry shop, hides, shoe factories, mini markets, nightclubs, loan sharking, cigarette smuggling, receiving stolen goods, drugs, infiltration of the post-earthquake construction sites. I broke into a cold sweat. What had I done? How could I have been so imprudent? In Florence, I had invented a plot, drawing on facts of my childhood and adolescence with the boldness that came from distance. Naples, seen from there, was almost a place of imagination, a city like the ones in films, which, although the streets and buildings are real, serve only as a background for crime stories or romances. Then, since I had moved and saw Leela every day, a mania for reality had gripped me, and although I hadn't named it, I had told the story of the neighborhood. But I must have overdone it, and the relationship between truth and fiction must have gone awry. Now, every street, every building had become recognizable, and maybe even the people, even the violent acts. The photographs were proof of what my pages really contained. They identified the area conclusively, and the neighborhood ceased to be, as it had always been for me while I was writing, an invention. The author of the article told the history of the neighborhood, even mentioning the murders of Don Achille Caracci and Manuela Solada. He went on at length about the latter, hypothesizing that it had been either the visible point of a conflict between Kimura families or an execution at the hands of the dangerous terrorist Pasquale Peluso, born and raised in the area, former bricklayer, former secretary of the local section of the Communist Party. But I hadn't written anything about Pasquale. I hadn't written anything about Don Achille or Manuela. The Carachis, the Saladas, had been for me only outlines, voices that had been able to enrich with the cadence of dialect, gestures, at times violent tonalities, a completely imagined scheme. I didn't want to stick my nose in their real business. What did the dominion of the Salada brothers have to do with it? I had written a novel. 91. I went to Leela's house in a state of great agitation. The children were with her.
"You're back already," said Elsa, who felt freer when I wasn't there.
And Dede greeted me distractedly, murmuring with feigned restraint, "Just a minute, Mama. I'll finish my homework and then hug you." The only enthusiastic one was Ima, who pressed her lips to my cheek and kissed me for a long time, refusing to let go. Tina wanted to do the same, but I had other things on my mind and paid them almost no attention. I immediately showed Leela Panorama. I told her about the Saladas, suppressing my anxiety. I said, "They're angry." Lena read the article calmly and made a single comment.
"Nice photos,"
I exclaimed. "I'll send a letter. I'll protest. Let them do a report on Naples. Let them do it on, I don't know, the kidnapping of Cirillo, on Camorra deaths, on what they want. But they shouldn't use my book gratuitously."
"And why?"
"Because it's literature. I didn't narrate real events."
"I recall that you did."
I looked at her uncertainly.
"What do you mean?
You didn't use the names, but a lot of things were recognizable."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"I told you I didn't like the book. Things are told or not told. You remained in the middle." "It was a novel."
"Partly a novel, partly not."
I didn't answer. My anxiety increased. Now, I didn't know if I was more unhappy about the Salada's reaction, or because she, serenely, had just repeated her negative judgment of years earlier. I looked at Dede and Elsa, who had taken possession of the magazine, but almost without seeing them.
Elsa exclaimed, "Tina, come see, you're in the newspaper."
Tina approached and looked at herself, eyes wide with wonder and a pleased smile on her face. Ima asked Elsa,
"Where am I?"
"You're not there, because Tina is pretty and you're ugly,"
her sister answered. Ima then turned to Dede to find out if it was true. And Dede, after reading the Panorama caption aloud twice, tried to convince her that since her name was Saratore and not Airota, she wasn't truly my daughter. I couldn't take it anymore. I was tired, upset. I cried, "That's enough. Let's go home." They all three objected, supported by Tina and by Leela, who insisted that we stay for dinner. I stayed. Leela tried to soothe me. She even tried to make me forget that she had again been critical of my book. She started off in dialect and then began to speak in the Italian she brought out on important occasions, which never failed to surprise me. She cited the experience of the earthquake. For more than 2 years, she had done nothing except complain of how the city had deteriorated. She said that since then, she had been careful never to forget that we are very crowded beings, full of physics, astrophysics, biology, religion, soul, Bourgeoisie, proletariat, capital, work, profit, politics. Many harmonious phrases, many unharmonious. The chaos inside and the chaos outside.
So calm down, she said, laughing. What do you expect the Saladas to be? Your novel is done. You wrote it. You rewrote it. Being here was evidently useful to you, to make it truer. But now it's out, and you can't take it back. The Saladas are angry. So what? Michele threatens you? Who gives a damn? There could be another earthquake at any moment, even stronger. Or the whole universe could collapse. And then, what is Michele Salada? Nothing. And Marcello is nothing. The two of them are merely flesh that spouts out threats and demands for money. She sighed. She said, in a low voice, The Saladas will always be dangerous beasts, Lainu. There's nothing to be done. I thought I had tamed one, but his brother made him ferocious again. Did you see how many blows Michele gave Alfonso? They're blows he wanted to give me, but he hasn't got the courage. And that rage at your book, at the article in Panorama, at the photos, is all rage against me. So don't give a shit. The way I don't give a shit. You put them in the newspaper, and the Saladas can't tolerate it. It's bad for business and for scams. To us, on the other hand, it's a pleasure, no? What do we have to worry about? I listened. When she talked like that, with those high-flown pronouncements, the suspicion returned that she had continued to consume books the way she had as a girl, but that for incomprehensible reasons she kept it hidden from me. In her house, not a single volume was to be seen, apart from the hyper-technical pamphlets that had to do with the work. She wanted to present herself as an uneducated person, and yet suddenly here she was talking about biology. Psychology, about how complicated human beings are. Why did she act like that with me? I didn't know, but I needed support, and I trusted her just the same. In other words, Leela managed to soothe me. I reread the article, and I liked it. I examined the photographs. The neighborhood was ugly, but Tina and I were pretty. We began to cook, and the preparations helped me reflect. I decided that the article, the photos, would be useful for the book, and that the text of Florence, filled out in Naples, in the apartment above hers, really was improved. Yes, I said. Let's screw the Saladas. And I relaxed. I was nice to the children again. Before dinner, after who knows what counsels, Ima came over to me, Tina trailing behind. In her language, made up of words that were pronounced clearly and words that were barely comprehensible, she said,
Mama, Tina wants to know if your daughter is me or her.
And do you want to know? I asked her. Her eyes were shining.
Yes.
Leela said, We are mamas of you both, and we love you both. When Enzo returned from work, he was excited about the photograph of his daughter. The next day he bought two copies of Panorama and stuck up in his office both the whole image and the image of his daughter alone. Naturally, he cut off the mistaken caption. 92. Today, as I write, I'm embarrassed at the way fortune continued to favor me. The book immediately aroused interest. Some were thrilled by the pleasure of reading it. Some praised the skill with which the protagonist was developed. Some talked about a brutal realism. Some extolled my Baroque imagination. Some admired a female narrative that was gentle and embracing. In other words, there were many positive judgments, but often in sharp contrast to one another, as if the reviewers hadn't read the book that was in the bookstores, but, rather, each had evoked a fantasy book fabricated from his own body.